Romans corrupted the Gaul, and that produced the Englishmen. They took to Roman ways like a hog to the trough. Roman tactics are direct. Make your families hostage. They enlisted us in their armies because that was our alternative to starvation. They corrupted our religion with greed. They replaced cheap, easily understood law with law that's expensive and mostly impenetrable to common folk. Legalized robbery is what it's all about. Joseph Herity. They refuse to confirm or deny whether they actually have O'Neill in custody? Velcourt asked. Charlie Turkwood raised both hands, palms upward. There was a saturnine look in his dark eyes. His thick lips appeared poised on the edge of a smile. They were in the Lincoln sitting room of the White House, a room Velcourt had set up as his private study. He glanced at his wristwatch. "What time is it over there right now?" "About 9 a.m., sir," Turkwood said. "Strange," Velcourt said. "How the hell did they find out that we have those dental charts and fingerprints?" Again Turkwood produced that negative shrug of the hands. Velcourt was hungry, and he knew this made him short-tempered. He struggled to control himself. "You know what I'm thinking, Charlie?" Turkwood nodded. The thing was obvious. "If they've broken the code on that plague," Velcourt said. "They could have us all by the balls," Turkwood said. An odd look of withdrawal came into Velcourt's eyes. He spoke in a musing tone. "Code? What's that?" Turkwood asked. Velcourt leaned toward the speakerphone on his desk and depressed the key. "Get me Ruckerman. I want him in here as soon as you find him. And D.A. too." The speaker burped a question. "Yes, I mean Asher." Another question. "I don't give a damn where Ruckerman's gone. Send a car." Turkwood stared at the president with a puzzled frown. "What are the odds that the Irish have rockets?" Velcourt asked. He leaned back in his chair. "The Pentagon thinks the odds are high, sir. They think the continent's vulnerable, at least." "A new plague, made in Ireland," Velcourt said. "That's what they're suggesting, sir." James Ryan Sadler, the science advisor, slipped into the study, saw Turkwood standing near the small desk, Velcourt seated in a comfortable swing chair behind it. "You're trying to find Ruckerman, Mr. President?" Sadler asked. He cleared his throat. "Anything I can do?" "Don't you knock before coming in here," Velcourt demanded. Sadler paled. "Amos was right outside, sir. He said..." "Okay, okay." Velcourt waved a placating hand. Again he leaned to the speakerphone. "Amos, prepare a message for my signature. It goes directly to the Irish government in Dublin. No named recipient. It will point out the number of people we lost getting those fingerprints and dental charts out of the plague area. Repeat our demand to know whether they have someone in custody they suspect is O'Neill, and if so, demand to know why they suspect this. Tell them we want an immediate reply and say we are still considering whether to send them copies of the fingerprints and dental charts. Immediate reply. Got that? The consequences of a failure to reply will be left to their imaginations." The speaker said, "Yes, sir." Velcourt returned to his position, leaning back in the chair, both hands clasped behind his head. "Is that wise, sir?" Turkwood asked. Velcourt did not respond. "What's going on?" Sadler asked. "There appears to have been a shake-up in the Irish power structure," Turkwood said. "We think the military is still in the saddle, but they've delegated authority to a split premiership, equal power to the Secretary of Plague Research, Fintan Doheny, and to the head of the Finn Saddle, Kevin O'Donnell." "What do our agents over there say about it?" Sadler asked. "We don't have one we can depend on." "Just when we need them the most," Velcourt said. "Why are we putting on the pressure, sir?" Turkwood asked. "Barrier command's sure to ask." "An immediate reply? I'll have to tell them something." "Tell them zilch. I'm talking to the Irish. They'll think we're up to something nasty, maybe looking for an excuse to nuke them. It'll throw them into a tizzy, or it'll produce an exposure of their hand. If they have a real threat, They'll have to make that known to us. Sadler said, Sir, I'm sure you know of the scenario that says we'll nuke anyone who admits they have O'Neill. Let 'em worry. They can't do a fucking thing except answer, and their answer will tell us a bundle. What about the possibility O'Neill has set up a dead man switch with another plague? Turkwood asked. The Russians and the Chinese say they're ready to risk it, Velcourt said. That's what the Joint Chiefs and I discussed last night. We're inclined to agree. But, sir, Sadler said, that could mean the Russians and Chinese have a cure. Velcourt shook his head. They can't manufacture an aspirin without our knowing about it. Turkwood looked at Sadler. What about our query to the Biochemical Society? Their records were computerized and lost, Sadler said. A few of the surviving members remember O'Neill, but... He shrugged. We have very few cards, and we have to play them right, Velcourt said. The big ones are those fingerprints and dental charts. We don't dare just give them away. I still think I'll have to tell Barrier Command something, Turkwood said. If I refuse to answer... What the hell is this sudden worry about Barrier Command? Velcourt demanded. Who cares what that Canuck Admiral thinks? Turkwood swallowed and looked grim. Yes, sir. Velcourt stared hard at Turkwood before speaking. What about that other little job you're supposed to be doing, Charlie? Turkwood shot a worried glance at Sadler before looking at the President. It's in hand, sir. I'm holding you responsible that it isn't botched. I'd better be getting back to it now. Is there anything else, sir? No. Keep me posted. You stay, Jimmy. When Turkwood had gone, Velcourt asked Sadler, How well do you trust Ruckerman? An honorable man, sir. He's been having unmonitored conversations with Beckett at Huddersfield. No record of what they said. I'm sure it was all technical, sir. Plague-related. That's what he says. Ruckerman doesn't lie, sir. Everybody lies, Jimmy. Everybody. Sadler frowned, but remained silent. Velcourt glanced at a scattered pile of reports on the small desk. Our situation gets no better. Hong Kong's a write-off. Chaos in South Africa. War of extermination against their black neighbors. The Soviets are voting to nuke the whole region. He slid one sheet from the papers and glanced at it before dropping it onto the pile. And now, Brazilian Israel has just declared itself independent of its host. Not that I blame them. CIA says the Brazilians were starting to make an identity list of all Israeli women for later use. The Brazilians were planning to trade surplus women to devastated areas. My God! Sadler swallowed, then... Sir, I need to discuss that last message from the Chinese Research Center at Changsha. They are asking for updates on computer-oriented study of the plague. I hesitate to... Stall them. What's the latest satellite report on that area north of Changsha? Some indications of panic fire, sir. But they have a disproportionate number of fireproof buildings. Even with augmented photos, we're very uncertain of what's happened there. We think maybe they tested a plague cure and it failed. Velcourt leaned to the speakerphone. Amos, I want an agency report on Changsha within the hour. He returned to his position, leaning back in the chair. I'm going to tell you something, Jimmy. It must not leave this room. I'll give you my reasons later. Sadler's face went solemn and fearful. Because of the places they've had to burn out, Velcourt said. The Soviets right now are weaker than wet shit. Their suicide rate has become astronomical. And we have to pretend we don't know this, and we'll have to continue this pose just as long as they have plenty of TU-29s and backfire threes and other instruments of total destruction. Do you understand that? Sadler nodded silently. The Australian Outback Reserve is still intact, and we've armed it, Velcourt said. That's an ace in the hole, but it could backfire. The Aussies can be goddamn independent at times, but they know their future is with us, sir. Do they? The President looked at the door through which Turkwood had just left. And now we come to Charlie Turkwood. He's been seen cozy-cozy with Shiloh Broderick. I don't understand, sir. Don't you know about Shiloh? Well, I thought everybody knew about Shiloh and his gang. Pretty reactionary, sir, so I hear. Reactionary? You want to know what's worrying them? World commerce is practically at a standstill. They're getting impatient. There's a lot of that going around, sir. It was a weak jest, and Sadler was sorry he'd attempted it as soon as he had spoken. But Velcourt grinned and said, "Thanks, Jimmy. That's one of the reasons I'm trusting you. We have to hold on to our sanity any way we can. Sir, the search for a cure has to be our only priority. At least our top priority. Which brings me to my reason for dumping all this on you. Ruckerman, what about him, sir? You're going to send him to Huddersfield. Sir, they're contaminated in... Which will give him a really strong motive to make good over there. If he fails, he'll never see his family again. Why are we doing this, sir? Velcourt looked at the papers on his study desk and abruptly swept them onto the floor. This goddamn job. Every time you turn around, another fucking distraction. Sir, what? I had this in my head weeks ago. All the pieces. But they don't give you a moment's peace to think. What about Ruckerman, sir? You are sending him to Huddersfield, Jimmy. Not me. You. I have nothing to do with it except to authorize your request. If you say so, sir, but I... You know David Asher. D.A.? A bright young fellow, sir, but what... I don't dare send him because Shiloh would hear about it, and he's bright enough to start poking in the wrong places. Everyone knows D.A. was using the satellite code to talk to his friends out in Mendocino. People are wondering how he did it, sir. Did he find a copy of... He did it with a thing he calls a computer search program. I know just enough about it to believe it could be adapted to breaking the plague code. The Chinese, Sadler said. Could they? They could, or they could have an independent approach. But why send this to Huddersfield, sir? After we get it to Beckett, we'll spread it around to our own facilities, but I don't have much confidence in them. Atlanta is a bunch of plotters. They couldn't find water if they crawled out of a submerged submarine. And Bethesda. They're trying hard, sir. Trying and plotting aren't enough. You have to be inspired. Beckett's my man. I can smell a solution, Jimmy. Always could. Which is why we're making sure this thing gets to Beckett at Huddersfield. There are those who'd try to prevent this, Jimmy. And Ruckerman's the right messenger. He's savvy with computers. I know, sir. He's been trying to get the Rocky Mountain facility to shift over to it. I saw the report. Damn. I saw the report and didn't even tumble to... Well, we're doing it now. How much do I tell Ruckerman? You tell him to keep his damn mouth shut. He talks only to Beckett. Ruckerman's cover is that he's there to make an on-site inspection and report to me. We're sending him because he was accidentally contaminated. Yes, sir, but... So he's got to be accidentally contaminated. And that will be as soon as possible after D.A. briefs him, which briefing will take place right here in my study. Details I will leave to you, but I have a suggestion. There's a young pilot named Cranmore McCrae living in Woodbridge just outside our perimeter. He's contaminated. He has made several requests that we allow him to fly to Ireland where he has an uncle. The uncle's some kind of a nut, but rich as hell and still powerful, apparently. I've had a full report on young McCrae. A fairly bright boy. He flew with the CIA Air Force in Vietnam and did a few other jobs for us. Resourceful and reliable. Why wouldn't this McCrae just go to Ireland once he was outside our... We tell the Canuck Admiral to shoot him down unless he goes directly to England. After he drops Ruckerman, then he can go to Ireland, where Barrier Command will do the usual with his aircraft. But what if the English won't? They will cooperate because you will tell them it would anger us exceedingly if they don't. If he fell into Irish hands, they might just cut his throat. The English are a bit more cautious. If you say so, sir. What have they got to lose? I mean, my God, he's one of my science advisors. Sadler's mouth felt as though it were filled with sawdust. All of this cloak-and-dagger intrigue. He felt like a non-person in the White House. The president trusted him, but this was not why he had entered government service. He thought then of the pressures he would have to put on Ruckerman, and it made his stomach turn sour. As though he read Sadler's mind, Velcourt said, "You're Ruckerman's closest friend here, Jimmy. I think you're the only one who could get him to do this." "It's not as though he had his family right here," Sadler said. "His wife's caught out there in the Sonoma Reserve, you know." "I know. I'll have to tell him quite a bit, sir." "I don't really care how much you tell him. Just make sure Turkwood doesn't get wind of it. It'd go right straight to Shiloh. I don't trust those bastards at all. I mean, Jimmy, Shiloh's people are a bunch of real nuts. Let me tell you. Their latest thing is they want to kill the Pope." In the long sweep of history, revenge is such a bore. The insane and the young idealists get caught up in it, though. The young want the old man to be guilty. That makes it easier to depose him. Young idealists are a danger in every age because they act without looking deeply enough into themselves or into the problems they address. They're driven mostly by their own hot blood. It's largely a sexual thing. They want control of the breeding stock. And the tragedy lies in the fact they mostly perpetuate new dreams of revenge for the next generation of young idealists. That, or they create a super madman, a Hitler, or an O'Neill. Fintan Craig Doheny. "You understand," Doheny said, "that we are necessarily concentrating a great deal of our effort on sex, chromatin bodies." "That doesn't surprise me," John said. "I presume you have facilities for fluorescent microscopy." "Oh, yes." They sat in Doheny's office high in the administration wing of Kilmainham Royal Hospital. It was a white-walled room about 6 meters square. Framed photographs of country landscapes and city scenes decorated the walls. John paid little attention to them after a first glance. Doheny sat in a comfortable chair behind a large desk. He was a wispy-haired troll with eyes that pinned down whatever they saw. John sat in a wooden chair across from Doheny. There was a yellow settee with a coffee table against one wall of the room. A bookcase filled the wall behind Doheny. Two windows on John's right looked out across the park-like grounds to Kilmainham Jail, where, he was told, Kevin O'Donnell had gone, that being his headquarters. They had come down to the city in armored cars. Father Michael, the boy, Herity, and Kevin O'Donnell riding in one, John and Doheny alone with a driver and one guard in the other. The cars had parted on Inchicore Road, the one carrying John turning to sweep under the arch into the hospital grounds. Doheny had led John up a short flight of steps, moving swiftly for such a heavy man. They had gone down a long hall of closed doors into an elevator and up 3 stories, down another hall to this glistening white room. A small man in a green smock had followed them inside and had taken John's fingerprints. "You don't mind, do you?" Doheny had asked. That had been almost an hour ago. John glanced down at the dark ink that solvent had failed to remove from his fingers. Why had they taken his fingerprints? John could feel the stirring of O'Neill within. Danger here. He had felt immersed in peril since the encounter on the road above Dublin. Doheny had been the man with Kevin O'Donnell, a curly fuzz like baby hair covering his round head. The face was benign, wide blue eyes, a short and thin nose, rather flat lips with smile creases. Jolly, that was the word for Doheny. But he radiated threat. Kevin O'Donnell had been the first to speak. I see you found warm clothing, Yank. Permit me to introduce Fintan Craig Doheny. Dr. Doheny is here to decide whether you live or die.
Doheny had remained silent.
Not looking at Kevin, John had pressed his lips together tightly to keep them from trembling. Herity and the others stood back, silent observers.
We know who you are, Kevin said.
For an instant, John thought his heart had stopped. He kept his attention on Doheny. The latter studied John with bland intensity.
John understood then.
Doheny was the hunter waiting at the waterhole, gaze unwavering, every sense concentrated on the kill. What bait had he staked out here?
"Have you nothing to say?"
Kevin asked. John found his voice, an astonishingly level tone emerging from icy calm. "What am I supposed to say?" He allowed himself to look at Kevin and met an eager stare.
"Of course you know who I am. You saw my passport."
"You're John Roe O'Neill,"
Kevin accused. John created a smile, forming it with exquisite slowness, his lips turning up, mouth slightly parted.
"Would you be telling us what you find humorous?"
Kevin demanded. John took a deep breath. He could hear it in Kevin's voice. Bluff. All of it. There was no bait at this waterhole.
"A lot of things have become clear to me," John said.
"You'll be explaining those words," Kevin said. John glanced at Herity standing there with a quizzical expression on his face, Father Michael looking withdrawn and pained, the boy huddled against the priest, then back to Doheny.
"Let's not play stupid games.
You've had Herity interrogating me all this time, and you—"
"He's a heavy-handed fellow, our Joseph," Kevin said. "That amuses you."
"I'm just relieved to understand finally what's been going on," John said. Kevin leaned forward on the balls of his feet.
"Then you're denying?"
"You're all being stupid," John said. "Ireland's the last place in the world the madman would come." Kevin looked squarely at John.
"We've thought on that. Were I the madman, I should want to play God. I should want to see what I had wrought. This is the madman's seventh day, this is. How can he not come here and admire his work?"
"That's mad," John said.
"And aren't we talking about a madman?" Kevin asked.
As John started to respond, Doheny raised a hand for silence. John understood then. Doheny was the Grand Inquisitor. Someone else put the questions and applied the pain. Doheny observed and judged. John studied the man. What was his judgment? For the first time in this encounter, Doheny spoke, a deep and compelling voice. John was surprised at the gentleness of it. Velvet, that voice.
"Let's bring him along," Doheny said. "I'll need his fingerprints, and we'll want a dentist to look in his mouth."
John felt his mouth go dry. Fingerprints and dental pattern. O'Neill within could be felt squirming. What evidence did the Irish Inquisitor possess? Nothing had been left at the college. Surely not at the house.
Had it?
Panic fire had been used there. He had heard it on the news while still in France. From that point, John had allowed himself to be moved along like a puppet, concentrating on presenting a bland expression. Bored. Long-suffering. The first half-hour in Doheny's office had been bad. Waiting.
Waiting.
What would the fingerprints reveal? When would they take him for a dental examination? Then a telephone had rung. Doheny had lifted it from a hook beside his desk, speaking one word into it.
"Doheny?"
He listened, then...
"Thank you."
"No, nothing else." The charade had been played out, Doheny thought, as he replaced the phone on its hook. This John Garrick O'Donnell had not broken. He now understood Herity's confusion.
What was it about this, John O'Donnell?
Doheny swiveled his chair and looked out the window toward Kilmainham Jail. Should the suspect be turned over to Kevin? The jail was a slippery place where men had died for no better reason than a whim. The present regime was only reinforcing that reputation.
Why did we choose that place for a seat of government? Doheny wondered. A terrible place. A monument to uncounted griefs.
He knew the answer.
Because it's large enough and small enough.
Because it's in Dublin.
Because we had to bring ourselves back together. Because we needed a symbol. And there's one thing to be said for Kilmainham. It's a symbol.
You say you're a molecular biologist, Doheny asked.
That's right. For about 20 minutes, then, John submitted to questioning about his knowledge, particular emphasis on recombinant DNA. Doheny displayed a considerable knowledge of the subject, but John had sensed the limits quite early when the questions lapsed into the area of educated guesses. John detected easily the areas where his own knowledge went far beyond Doheny's, especially when they got into synthesis interfaces. The trick was to limit what was revealed in the answers. Doheny tipped back in his chair, hands behind his head.
Where would you consider yourself most valuable?
My micromethodology is considered to be very good.
That's what you concentrated on at this University of Washington?
Among other things.
Without tipping his head, Doheny lowered his gaze to his bare desktop.
You've had experience with mitotically active small lymphocytes?
Oh, yes.
Doheny leaned forward, elbows on the desk, hands clasped loosely in front of him.
I suspect you're more conversant with the subject than I am. We have made some discoveries, however.
John felt his pulse quicken. There was a sense of questioning from O'Neill within.
I'm anxious to know about your progress, John said.
I want to caution you about your approach to this plague, Doheny said. As a medical researcher, you will tend to have a bias about disease. The plague ignites a particular susceptibility to that mistake.
John took a moment to respond. What was Doheny saying? Was he stalling? Had the Irish discovered nothing significant after all this time? When John failed to speak, Doheny said,
You are required to face absolute termination immediately. To the traditional researcher, diseases are things that run their course. Life goes on even if a particular case is not cured.
John nodded and held his silence.
We expect immunities to develop, Doheny said. Or we expect some other natural process to intervene. But the plague will terminate mankind unless we solve it.
O'Neill within whispered in John's mind.
They've found out about the long dormancy phase.
It came to John then that Doheny was still probing, subtly and expertly seeking after O'Neill. As he thought this, John felt O'Neill withdraw deep within. Doheny was more dangerous than Herity. What had happened to Herity, the priest, and the boy?
Quarantine will not work forever, Doheny said.
John found that he was taking short, shallow breaths. He tried to breathe deeper, but his chest pained him.
Have you confronted the fact that we may face an unsolvable problem? Doheny asked.
John shook his head.
There has to be a solution.
He thought about his own words. It had never occurred to him that O'Neill's revenge might be an ultimate failure for mankind. Every problem could be solved. He knew how the plague had been created. The form of it lay there in his mind, an internal movie that he could play at will.
No cure. That was insane. Have you noticed that we're not creating any hopeful new myths here in Ireland?
Doheny asked.
What?
Doheny's words bounced around in John's awareness.
What was the man saying? Only the old myths of death and destruction, Doheny said. It's fitting we should originate the literature of despair.
What is that to do with...
What greater proof of ultimate defeat?
Have you given up?
That's not the point, John. May I call you John?
Yes, but... What are...
Recognizing ultimate defeat does terrible psychic damage, John. Bitter, bitter consequences.
But you yourself just suggested
that we may have to swallow the bitter pill.
John stared at the man. Was he insane? Was this a variation on the mad priest at the clothing hut?
What do you say to this, John? Doheny asked.
Where are Herity, Father Michael, and the boy? Doheny looked startled.
What's your concern about them?
I just wondered.
They're not Ireland, John.
Yes, they are, John thought. They're my Ireland. Revenge had created them, shaped them like clay on a potter's wheel. The silent boy loomed large in his mind. What would the boy be if there were nothing fragile or pathetic about him? There must be strength in him somewhere. John tried to visualize the boy maturing, those fawn's eyes. A heartbreaker should any mature female ever get to know him. But that would never happen if Doheny's suspicions proved true. No more agony for that boy, John thought. It's enough. O'Neill within is content. We're not defeated, John said.
And that's what I'm warning you about, John. Look around you. Defeated people always try to compensate with myths and legends.
We're not talking about myths and legends.
Oh, but we are. We're talking about the retrospective curtains that hide unacceptable facts. Not disaster, but heroic tales. No people has ever been more accomplished at myth creation than we Irish.
No more hope, John said, his voice low, remembering Grandpa Jack and the magic stories beside the fireplace.
The devil's own truth, Doheny said. Imagine it, John. Everything in our history conspired to strengthen the Irish faculty for the heroic myth to soften defeat.
Tell that to Father Michael.
Michael Flannery?
Oh, now, even the church did stalwart duty with its myths. Defeat reduced to divine justice, God's revenge for past misbehavior. The English even had a hand in this. With a kind of unwitting perversity, they outlawed our religion. Prohibition always strengthens what it bans.
John's thoughts whirled in confusion. What lay behind Doheny's words? Doheny patted his bulging stomach. The starvations were a peculiar Irish trauma, a lesson we've never forgotten. Compulsive eating is our most common response to adversity.
John decided this must be mad rambling. No real point in it, no reasoning behind it.
I'm one of the few fat men in Ireland these days, Doheny said.
Then you haven't given up.
I may be the only myth-maker left to us, Doheny said.
Inspired research. That's what we need right now. John shook his head, uncomprehending.
We've been sitting here composing a myth about John Garrick O'Donnell, Doheny said.
Garrick. He rolled it out in that velvet voice. John Garrick O'Donnell. A fine old Irish name.
It demands a special myth, it does.
What in the hell are you talking about?
I'm talking about John Garrick O'Donnell, a Yankee descendant of strong Gaelic stock.
That's what I'm talking about. You've come back to us, John Garrick O'Donnell. You've brought us a sensational new approach to the plague.
You're a vision of hope, John Garrick O'Donnell. I'll put it about immediately.
Are you nuts?
People will admire you, John.
For what?
for your vision. The Irish always admire vision. I'll not be a party to... Then I'll have to turn you over to Kevin for immediate disposal. We've plenty of lab technicians. What we need is inspiration and hope. And what happens if I don't... If you fail? Ah, then that's the end of you right there. We're not very tolerant of failure, we aren't. You mean you just kill off? Oh, no. Nothing so bloody or simple. But Kevin has a short temper and a quick gun. Then I'll have to hide my mistakes. Not from me, you won't. Doheny pushed himself away from his desk. We'll be sending you along to Peard at Killaloe. I suggest you work out your sensational new approach to the plague before you arrive. John's gaze followed Doheny as the man arose. Do or die? Isn't that the nature of our problem? Doheny asked. John forced his gaze away from Doheny. The way the man stood there, accusing. You see, John, Doheny said, there's new pressure from the plague. The thing is mutating. It's into the mammals of the sea. The whales, the porpoises, the seals and such. No stopping the spread of it now. John knew his face was a frozen mask. Mutation. There was something he had not considered. It had gotten out of hand. The thing was a wildfire. If you'll just wait here, Doheny said, I'll go and lay on your travel arrangements. He led himself out into the hall. Kevin already was there, emerging from the adjoining office. You're a fool, Doheny, Kevin whispered. What if he tries to destroy our work at Killaloe? Then you'll have to kill him, Doheny said. Have they sent the fingerprints and dental charts yet? They're playing it cautious. Why do we want them? Do we have a suspect? Why else do they think we'd ask? It was dangerous to ask, Kevin. It's dangerous to live. Kevin, if that's O'Neill in there, and if I've motivated him correctly, he'll solve the thing for us. You as much as told him it couldn't be cured. That surprised him, you know. He was shocked. Never thought about it before. Typical researcher. Eyes on the goal. And what if you're right? Kevin asked. What if it's O'Neill and he fails? Then hope is dead for sure. A doctor says, Sir, it would be better to die according to the rules than to live in contradiction to the faculty of medicine. Molière, speaking to a patient who recovered with unorthodox treatment. William Ruckerman's first meeting with his pilot was on the field at Hagerstown, Maryland. Dawn opened a thin crack of light along the eastern horizon. It was cold, it was misty wet, and Ruckerman was nursing a nervous stomach. He had been staying in a military-run hotel near the field for 2 days before weather said it was safe to make the transatlantic flight. The 2 days had been a sniffly, headachy period in which he had experienced the growing certainty that he was suffering the benign symptoms of the plague, realizing with an empty feeling that he was now a carrier. Someone from the Washington power elite had to do this, though, the long-term stakes being what they were. Beckett's little cabal had really nailed down the potential, but they were crazy if they thought they could control it by themselves. Cranmore McRae, the pilot, turned out to be a short and rather stout young man with an oversized head, a head so large that Ruckerman decided it must be the result of hormone imbalances. McRae, standing just inside the plane, appeared deformed. Small blue eyes set widely apart over a flat nose, long mouth with thick lips and blocky jaw which moved on a hinge far back against his neck. The plane was a small twin jet of a model Ruckerman did not recognize. It looked like an expensive executive aircraft, sleek and fast, with its nose jutting far out over the front gear. The door folded down to become stairs. The sergeant who had driven Ruckerman to the field stood at the foot of the stairs, damp wind whipping his coat, until McRae closed the door and sealed it.
McCrae strapped Ruckerman's bag into an empty seat, then led the way forward, beginning the oddest interrogation Ruckerman had ever experienced. "Tell me, Dr. Ruckerman," McCrae asked, "is there any reason Charlie Turkwood might want you dead?" Ruckerman, who was seating himself in the right-hand side of the cockpit and beginning to fasten his seatbelt, stopped and stared at McCrae. What a strange question. Ruckerman wondered if he had heard it correctly. "Fasten your seatbelt there," McCrae said. "We're getting the hell out of here." "Are you suggesting Charlie Turkwood might want me dead?" Ruckerman asked, clipping the lock of his seatbelt. "That's the general idea." McCrae donned a headset and adjusted a microphone close to his lips. He thumbed a switch on the control wheel. "This is Rover Boy," he said. "Ready to taxi." "Clear to taxi, Rover Boy." The metallic voice from the tower came from an overhead speaker. Ruckerman looked up at the grill. "I have no idea what you're talking about," he said. And he wondered what Jim Sadler had gotten him into. People wanting him dead. He mused on this as McCrae cleared for the runway, taxied into position, and aimed the aircraft down the long field. McCrae looked at him then. "I sure hope you're right." He pushed the throttles to the firewall. The plane gathered speed, slowly at first, then pressing Ruckerman back into the cushions. Liftoff was smooth, followed by rapid climb out over the low overcast. Ruckerman blinked in the bright sunlight reflected off a fleecy ocean of clouds. "About 6.5 hours estimated flying time," McCrae said. "Why the devil did you ask that question about Turkwood?" Ruckerman demanded. "I was a CIA pilot, and I still have a few friends around to tell me things. Can I call you Will? I hear that's what your friends call you." Ruckerman spoke stiffly. "Call me whatever you like, just so long as you explain this, Will. My friends say Turkey is bad news. I've been nosing around, you know, trying to find out if there might be some jokers in this deck. Some other reason for our little trip." "What other reason could there possibly be?" Ruckerman looked out at the cloud cover, a changing landscape without any safe reference. He wondered if they had assigned him a mad pilot. "You really think the Irish have that madman O'Neill?" McCrae asked. "They want me to look into that after I drop you off." "I'm sure I couldn't say," Ruckerman said. "I know that sergeant who drove you out to the field," McCrae said. "An odd job, man. What did you two talk about during the drive?" He wondered who had arranged for me to do this. I told him I thought it originated with the president himself." "Christ on a crutch," McCrae said. "Will you tell me what this is all about?" "Look, Will," McCrae said, "we're at 32,000 right now, and things look pretty smooth here. I'm going to put this bird on automatic while I go back and have a look around. You just sit tight and don't touch anything. Sing out if you see any other planes, okay? Look around." "For what?" "I'd feel a lot better about this flight if I was sure we weren't packing something that'll go boom." "A bomb?" Ruckerman felt a tight sensation in the pit of his stomach. McCrae had unbuckled his harness and slipped out of it. He stood bent over, looking back at Ruckerman. "It could be just my native caution." He turned away and left the compartment, but his voice was still audible to Ruckerman. "Damn. I should have demanded to make my own inspection of this bird." Ruckerman turned and looked out the windscreen. Their flight path was taking them diagonally across a deep chasm in the clouds, a gray glimpse of ocean through the screening mists far below. This was insane. This whole trip did not ring true suddenly. He was tempted to tell McCrae to turn back. But would McCrae obey him? And even if McCrae agreed, would they be allowed to return? "This is a one-way trip until we find the cure," Sadler had said. Ruckerman thought of the deep banks of anti-aircraft missiles around Washington. One MUSAM with its multi-headed heat and motion seekers. McCrae slipped back into his seat and buckled his harness. "I can't find a damn thing." He checked his instruments and looked then at Ruckerman. "How'd they rope you into this?" "I was the obvious choice." "Yeah? For what?"
I have the confidence of the President and his chief advisers. I have the scientific background to, well, assess things. My friends say you may be a patsy.
What do you mean?
There's a lot of hate going around against science and scientists. How'd you get contaminated anyway?
Ruckerman swallowed. This was the tricky part.
It was a stupid thing. I went through a wrong door at one of the quarantine stations. They should not have left that door unlocked.
And maybe you should have been more careful.
Ruckerman searched in his mind for a way to divert the conversation. Then,
how were you chosen as my pilot?
I volunteered.
Why?
I have an uncle in Ireland.
A real oddball.
Never married. Rich enough to pay off the national debt. McCrae grinned.
And I'm his only living relative.
Is he still... alive?
He has a ham radio. Ham operators have been passing along his messages. Uncle Max got himself a private estate over there.
And this'll get you.
He's reviving the religion of Druidism.
Tree worship. The whole Megillah.
He sounds crazy.
Not crazy. Just weird.
And you're his only heir.
How can you be sure of that?
Or that inheritance will...
Things have changed, you know.
McCrae shrugged. Uncle Mac and I are lookalikes. He was always pretty fond of me. Things being the way they are, what better thing do I have on my plate than to go over and look after my own interests?
Well, I wish you luck.
You too, Will. You're going to need it.
I still don't understand what made you suspect a bomb.
I know things about Turkwood that most people don't even whisper.
You know him?
From before the plague, and since then, by phone. That's what worries me, Will. I know things he might want erased.
You, though, I can't figure why he might want you out unless it's just another write-off.
Ruckerman tried to swallow in a dry throat, remembering how cautious Sadler had been. Not a word of what he carried in his case. The special search program from DA, none of that must get to Turkwood. That had been the reason for the ridiculous charade at the quarantine station.
Accidental contamination.
You okay? McCrae asked.
You look sort of peaked.
This is insane, Ruckerman muttered. It's vital that I get to England.
And you must get to Ireland. Find out if they really have O'Neill.
My God, if it's O'Neill and he could be persuaded to talk.
If,
McCrae said. If they really have O'Neill, and if the son of a bitch is still alive.
I don't know, Will.
If I were in Ireland and I had that guy in my hands,
they know how important it would be to preserve him.
Do they? And what difference does it make to them? What have they got to lose?
McCrae released his harness.
I'm going back for another look around. Same drill. Don't touch anything, Will.
Mr. McCrae?
Call me Mac.
Yes, well. Mac.
Ruckerman shook his head.
No. It's too wild.
Nothing's too wild. What's making you nervous?
Both Dr. Sadler and the President were very anxious that... this trip be kept secret from Turkwood. That is, until...
Secret? Why?
I don't know.
You do know, but you're not saying.
Christ, I've got myself another hot cargo.
I'm sorry, Mac, but this is all probably just our active imaginations.
These are times for active imaginations.
He stared at the instrument panel. Presently, he touched a white button above the throttle console. A red light went on above the button.
That could be because we're going too fast, he muttered.
He disengaged the autopilot, grasped the throttles, and eased them back.
Ruckerman watched the airspeed indicator crawl back into the green band, stopping at 120. Again McCrae touched the white button. Again the red light flashed.
Could be a circuit malfunction, McCrae said.
"What are you doing?" Ruckerman asked. McRae pushed the throttles forward, checked their course, and restored the autopilot. They were out over open ocean, only a thinly scattered cloud cover underneath. The sun was bright, throwing white sparkles off the waves. "There's a little barometric switch gadget that's been used a few times," McRae said. "My friends once said Turkwood likes it. It's attached to a wad of plastic explosive, and the whole thing's seated in a landing gear compartment. It's armed when you lower the gear, and if you go below a set altitude, kapowie."
What set altitude?
Maybe a couple hundred meters.
Right down there, when you're on final, the field in front of you, and not a damn thing you can do about it. No time to jump out with a parachute, provided you even have a parachute, which we don't. Right down there, where you're sure to smear yourself all over the landscape. Real helmet funeral stuff.
Helmet funeral? They recover just about enough of your body to fill a standard flight helmet.
What evidence do you have that...
That little red light there. Emergency confirmation circuit. Green says gears up and seated, or down and seated, whichever shows on this indicator up here. McRae pointed to another switch above his right knee. A green gear-up light glowed above the switch.
When I test, the light says gears not up, but we're flying as though everything's in order.
Could there be some other explanation?
Circuit malfunction?
But Jesus! A whole platoon of mechanics checked out this bird.
Ruckerman thought about this for a moment. He took a deep breath and shook his head.
It's paranoid.
With Turkwood?
That's the safest way to go.
Ruckerman felt anger taking over. It was an emotion he loathed. The mind did not work clearly with any strong emotion.
Rational thought. The world's only future lay in rational thought.
Science failed when rational thought failed. The anger continued to mount.
"What the hell can we do about it?" he demanded. "How can we be sure your suspicions are even..."
"Let me think about it, Will."
McRae checked his instruments and the autopilot, confirmed their position, and leaned back in his seat. He closed his eyes.
Ruckerman watched him, embarrassed by the angry outburst.
A patsy.
McRae's suspicions were all fantasy. The computer program, the summations of other projects, all of the material back there in that bag. And O'Neill possibly in Ireland.
God.
He might even get a chance to interview the man personally.
What could be more important than that?
The president might do many things to stay in power and keep his world in order, but he certainly would not jeopardize the efforts to find a plague cure.
Slowly, Ruckerman grew aware of a strange sound. He looked at McRae. The man was snoring.
The bastard was asleep. How could he sleep after...
After...
McRae snorted and sat upright, opening his eyes.
"They've got lakes in England," he said. "A high lake. Or maybe even a high field."
He reached down to his left, fingered through a series of charts there, and extracted one, opening it in front of him. He scanned it, his lips working.
"Yeah. Yeah, a nice high one right up there above Aberfeldy."
He restored the chart to its place beside him.
"We fake engine trouble and swoosh."
"How far will we be from Huddersfield?" Ruckerman asked.
"Don't worry, Will," McRae said. "You're a VIP. They'll wheel you around in a limousine. Me, I'm small potatoes and few in the hill. I gotta find a way to get back to Ireland and then to Uncle Mac's place."
McRae turned and grinned at Ruckerman, a wide, toothy expression in that lantern-jawed face.
"Besides, I'm captain of this here ship. I say where she goes."
Ruckerman scowled at him, then turned away.
Insane suspicions.
But a few more hours' delay, what did it really matter? Just as long as McRae was satisfied.
The selfish bastard.
Hair-brained. Another thought crept into Ruckerman's mind.
He turned toward McCrae. Granting that there's an explosive device on this plane, what if it's set to go off after a certain time?
Then we feed the fishes, McCrae said.